The Guardian.
This podcast is being recorded in front of a live audience. Hello, this is a special Science Weekly podcast, live-ish from London's Science Museum. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, we're talking about genius. I'll be speaking to the modern-day genius, Sir James Dyson.
Bravery and effrontery, whatever you want to call it, arrogance, is an extremely important element. You've got to want to change the world. You've got to want to believe that your idea is a good idea.
Nell Bowes will be testing out her IQ. We're hoping for a world record.
Very first question, the one that you should be able to answer, is what is 4 pounds and 5 pounds?
How do you mean? Oh, what? Plus?
In samples getting up close and personal, with some history of genius, as the Babbage difference engine comes back to life.
8,000 different parts, 4,000 in the main calculating body of the machine and another 4,000 in the printing section. And it weighs about 5 tonnes.
Psychologist Dr. Kevin Dutton will demonstrate the art of split-second persuasion and how you can use it to your advantage.
Churchill spots a fellow guest about to steal a solid silver salt cellar from the table. So imagine that was you. Put yourself in that position. What would you do?
We're in the company of greatness here at the Science Museum today. I've just seen Professors Richard Dawkins and Jim Al-Khalili, and also Lord Robert Winston. Oh, and I nearly forgot, the man who almost personifies genius, Professor Stephen Hawking's here too. Plus, and most important, we're getting to meet our listeners for the very first time. As they can see, I've put on my best shirt specially. This is The Guardian Science Weekly podcast, live-ish from the Science Museum in London. Hello and welcome to everyone here and listening elsewhere. I'm standing in the cavernous energy hall here at the Science Museum. It's evening right now and usually this place would be empty, apart from security guards slowly roaming the corridors. But you can probably hear there's a bit of a buzz. Once a month, the doors here are opened up for Science Museum Lates, a night of child-free entertainment. This is a night of science for grown-ups. They even serve alcohol. Tonight's theme is genius. And we thought tonight this would be the perfect venue for this podcast's first ever recording in front of a live audience. How exciting. Right now, thousands of eager punters are exploring these hallowed corridors of the home of science. They're taking part in human table football, learning how to dance like Einstein, and listening to talks on improving their memory and also how to become a sporting genius. There's something about improving memories too. Later on, to wind things up, there's a themed pub quiz and a silent disco. As well as this podcast, there's another main event taking place here tonight, a discussion about how British ingenuity has helped shape the world. I've already mentioned some of the luminaries wandering around, but before I jump into the lift and rush down to the basement, where we're going to record the rest of this programme, I want to introduce someone we've never heard from before in this podcast. One of the most celebrated scientists of modern times, he's a British theoretical physicist, an academic celebrity, and author of the bestseller A Brief History of Time. This is Professor Stephen Hawking.
I am very pleased to be on this Channel 4 series. Normally, they only call me in the hope that I will appear on Big Brother. These programs are a bit more serious. They tell the stories of the British scientists who came before us. From Isaac Newton to James Clerk Maxwell, from Charles Darwin to Francis Crick. They also explain how scientists created the modern world. This country has a wonderful record in science, technology, and medicine. We also have outstanding universities and research institutes. The Cavendish Laboratory alone has produced 29 Nobel Prize winners, which is more than Italy and Spain combined. Our scientific history is extraordinary. From gravity to electricity, the discovery of hydrogen and oxygen, the computer and the internet, Darwin to the double helix, steam engines and suspension bridges, the television, and the telephone. Yet despite all this, there is a real concern that students are no longer choosing to study science. The number of students studying physics is falling, while the number taking media studies is rising. So the idea of this series is not just to celebrate the achievements of the past, but to inspire the next generation of scientists. And to remind everyone of the vital role science will play in all our futures. In science, we are all standing on the shoulders of giants.
Not a bad way to start this podcast. Professor Stephen Hawking there, addressing the start of one of the earlier panels here at the Science Museum. Well, hello, London. It's the closest I'm ever going to get to being on stage somewhere. Well, welcome to the basement here in the London Science Museum. They're clearly trying to keep us well away from the rest of tonight's event. This room is called Things, more usually occupied by excitable 7 to 11-year-olds, perfect for our childish sense of humour. It's a good job this thing isn't on video, as you probably develop a headache pretty quickly. The walls in this room, for those listening, are about as garish and brightly coloured as you can get. And I'm told, true fact this, the man responsible for designing the TV sets on Eurotrash, Gilles Senanzandotti, also designed this artwork. Thank you to our audience members who've turned up this evening to witness a masterclass in broadcasting. Hopefully we'll be coming to you lot throughout the programme with our roving mic. Also, we've got a Twitter fall behind us. So if anyone can get a signal down here and you want to comment on the evening, please use the hashtag SWLive. And if you see anything amusing during it, please feel free to giggle, but try not to distract this crack team of commandos here on the panel. Let me introduce the top table here. I'm Alok Jha, one of the Guardian Science correspondents. Over there, right at the end, is the other Guardian Science correspondent, Ian Sample. Next to him is The Guardian's Nell Bowes. And next to me, here on my left, is producer Andy. Now, before we start talking about the genius stuff, let's introduce our guest for the programme. This is the psychologist, Dr. Kevin Dutton, on my right. Kevin is a research fellow at the Faraday Institute at the University of Cambridge. His speciality is the psychology of social influence, and he's just written a book called Flipnosis. Welcome, Kevin.
Hi, thanks, Alec.
This is the first podcast you've been on of ours, and we've kind of dropped you into it a little bit, being live, but you're up for this.
Yep, definitely open for business.
Now, we're going to talk about your book at the end of the programme, but he's got a bit of a trick to try and go through with you guys, so why don't you do your special Bob Dylan-esque sort of example?
Okay. Well, to kick the show off, guys, what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you on a very low-tech series of cards some numbers, and these numbers correspond to an addition sum that I want you guys to add up out loud as I'm revealing each number in sequence, okay? So just to make sure that you do have a voice, I want you to say out as loud as you possibly can the number 100. Say it now.
100. Okay, come on, a bit louder than that, guys.
A bit louder, yeah.
100. Okay, honestly, okay. Science geeks just sometimes need a bit of warming up. So that's fine. Why don't you start?
Okay, so what I'm going to do, I'm going to reveal these numbers to you on this card, and I want you to add them up as quickly as possible out loud.
So keep adding as he goes along. So, Kevin, off you go. Go for it, guys.
1,000. Just leave it there for now. We'll come back to that a bit later.
We'll leave it there. Slightly confused members of the audience there, but we're gonna go through why some of you might have got that wrong, some of you might have got that right a bit later in the programme. Right, we're going to talk about genius first, though. What is a genius? Here's what the genius of the internet, Wikipedia, says. A genius, plural genii or geniuses, is a person, a body of work, or a singular achievement of surpassing excellence. More than just originality, creativity, or intelligence, genius is associated with achievement of insight, which has transformational power. Sounds a bit like us. Right, quick questions to you, panel. Ian Sample, who is your favourite genius and why?
My favourite genius is, at a pinch, Max Planck, I think.
Max Planck?
Yeah, because he
named lots of institutes in Germany.
He did do that, and I think that was a brilliant move in itself. But what I really like him for, he had a spectacular moustache as well, but also he got interested in possibly the most dull experiment in the world, which was watching basically ovens heat up and the colours they go as that happens, and he turned that into basically the quantum revolution. And I think if you can do that, hats off, genius.
I regularly watch ovens heat up, but I don't get any insight.
They always have cakes in though when you do.
Yeah, probably. Nell, who's your genius and why?
I think mine's Richard Feynman, just for the sheer breadth and the way that you get someone who's incredibly good at explaining things and can be an artist and a drummer and a comedian and at the same time look at things in such a different way that you get quantum diagrams out of it.
You don't get many quantum physicists who are actually also comedians and win Nobel Prizes. Kevin, who's your hero?
My hero is Carl Friedrich Gauss, the 19th century mathematician. And the reason I say that is because I heard a wonderful story about Gauss when he was a seven-year-old, which to me epitomises what genius is all about. Gauss was 7 years old. He was at school in Germany, and his teacher came in one day, obviously with a pile of marking to do, gave the class a task to add up all the numbers between 1 and 100, 1 plus 2 plus 3, and he started them off on the board, sat down, and he thought it would take them best part of an hour. But after about 20 seconds, the young 7-year-old Gauss put up his hand and said, "I've got the answer, it's 5,050. And the teacher had no idea how he'd done it, so he called him out to the front of the class, and Gauss then explained that rather than going through the numbers in sequence, he had actually discerned a pattern in the sequence from 1 to 100. And if you think about it, 1 plus 100 is 101, 2 plus 99 is 101, 3 plus 98 is 101. So the 7-year-old Gauss said all you need to do is times 101 by 50, and you get the answer, which was 5,050.
See, I knew that.
Well, you are the only other man ever to have worked it out.
I know that if you want to calculate 100 factorial, what you do is it's n squared plus n divided by 2. I know that formula.
That's because you learnt it from Gauss.
Okay, if you say so. My genius is Delia Smith, for reasons I think that people might already realise. And also, I think she is fantastic at baking things generally. Now, audience, please tweet who your genius is onto the screen. And earlier, I spoke to someone who could be considered by many to be a genius. Sir James Dyson is an English industrial designer, perhaps best known for his bagless vacuum cleaner and also some fancy new hand dryers we have at work. He's estimated to be worth more than £1 billion, and I spoke to him a bit earlier.
Well, a lot of people call geniuses because what they did looks amazing. I mean, Whittle with his jet engine, which I'm going to talk about tonight. But actually, what's really behind it is a lot of hard work, bravery, and persistence. So someone can look like a genius when they've achieved this amazing breakthrough, but really what was behind it were those characters, not necessarily that he's brilliant.
So this is the 99% perspiration argument, that a genius can only be a genius if that's the ratio of work to inspiration.
Yes, I think you'll find that all geniuses worked extremely hard. Mozart worked extremely long hours.
Who's your favourite genius?
Well, I've got several. I mean, Whittle is one of my favourites because he started off as a very poor person with very little secondary education. And through building wonderful models of aeroplanes, he was noticed by the Air Force and got into the graduate training scheme and eventually went to Cambridge and invented the jet engine before he went to Cambridge, built one while he was at Cambridge, and came out and changed the aviation world and created enormous wealth for Britain. So he was brilliant. And what was extraordinary about it is that before that, we had piston engines with thousands of moving parts. A jet engine has one moving part, and that is brilliant in conception.
Do you think that in the years to come, people might think of you as a genius too?
No, not at all. They'll think of me just as someone who worked hard and perhaps who had a little bit of vision and who dared to do things. Bravery and effrontery, whatever you want to call it, arrogance, is an extremely important element. You've got to want to change the world. You've got to want to believe that your idea is a good idea.
That was Sir James Dyson there talking about his favourite genius. So, panel, what do you make of what Sir James said there? Ian, what do you think about this 99% perspiration argument? Basically, geniuses, he's saying, are very sweaty people.
I mean, I don't have a different definition, but I think I have a different definition of my favourite kind of genius. And he was talking about, he said you've got to want to change the world as being part of his definition of genius. I don't think that's the case. I think there are several geniuses in history who did it accidentally. I mean, Max Planck was key among them. I think for me, a genius is someone who wrong-foots the perceived wisdom with spectacular consequences. That's my favourite kind of genius, someone who just comes up with something that is so out of the blue that everyone else just looks around and said, where did that come from? And I don't think, you know, making brilliant vacuum cleaners is an excellent thing to do. I think that's hard work and brilliance rather than genius, personally. But I don't want to diss James Dyson.
I'm not going to let you diss James Dyson. Those hand dryers are amazing. What's your definition of genius? And do you agree with Ian that it has to be world changing or not world changing? In fact.
I don't know. I take what you say about the kind of the idea that it's a genius of somebody who can kind of see the gestalt and step outside it or take it from a different angle and add something completely new to the debate. But I came across, I was talking to a chap who was doing IQ tests. Obviously, you know, IQ tests, intelligence, a bit of a difficult relationship there. But he said it's fascinating. There's a definition of imbecile. There's a definition of moron. There's no definition of genius at the other end of the scale because it's so difficult to define. And you might get, it is possibly somebody who's intelligent, but it's also possibly the kind of person who can't even complete an IQ test because they're just heading at things in a completely different manner. It's quite nice to see that you couldn't actually define it in that way.
Kevin, as a psychologist and, you know, probably the person on this panel who has most, you know, proper ways of trying to define these things, is there any sort of scientific definition for genius?
Well, if you look at the traditional definition of genius as measured by IQ tests, I mean, there's certainly some basis to the fact that IQ tests can provide us with some information about intelligence in terms of somebody's working memory, in terms of their linguistic ability or mathematical ability. But one of the problems with genius as defined, say, by intelligence testing traditionally in psychology is it's very difficult to actually parse out the people who are geniuses from the people who are geniuses at passing or doing well on those particular tests.
So this is a bit like those brain training things, that you can get good at something just because of practice.
You can get very good at things. I mean, I know somebody, for instance, who trained to perform an IQ test and actually raised their IQ by 30 points to 60. No, not really to 60, but you can raise your IQ by quite a margin just by practicing on those particular kinds of tasks.
The thing is, though, I mean, if you were to define genius as creativity, perhaps, I mean, is that one way of thinking about it? I mean, Max Planck might have been doing something quite dull in studying ovens, Ian, but what came out of that was essentially quantum mechanics.
I was miles away. I was watching the tweet.
Just concentrate
things.
Here for 3 seconds.
What's your question?
Honestly. Max Planck, your genius here. He might have been doing something quite boring, but it took a creative mindset to turn that into quantum physics.
Let me tell you something else that was genius about Max Planck, was that
an answer to my question, or is it just going to be something you're going to tell me?
No, it's going to help you understand the man. He got someone else to do the boring bit. He was a theoretician, so he got the guys down the corridor to do the experiment and actually sit in front of the ovens. And stare and mark down the colours and the temperatures and look at the wavelength distributions of the light coming out. And then he went, actually, okay, he did the hard bit, but he didn't actually have to sit through and do what you might regard as the boring part.
Well, creativity is more than just working out equations and things. It's more than just, you know, what we might traditionally think of creativity. I mean, science, physics, all of these things, quantum mechanics, are incredibly creative things because they completely go outside our worldview. No.
But in terms of, I mean, if you're talking about creativity as though it's something that's easily defined, but yet actually trying to define what constitutes creativity is still just, it's so nebulous. It's very difficult to get a hold on in any kind of philosophical definition.
So Kevin, I mean, is there any way of capturing that at all? I mean, these people, Einstein, Faraday, all these people who are considered geniuses, how would you have captured their genius in terms of creativity? Because that's clearly an important part.
It's very, very difficult to capture creative genius with any particular test. I think that to sort of paraphrase Dyson, I think, you know, my favourite definition of genius is 99% desperation and 1% inspiration. I think that ability to really want to put in the hours to build on your raw talent, I think, is very important. And I think that the reason why I really love Carl Gauss is because the story with the sequence of numbers really shows for me what a genius is all about. It's somebody that completely looks at something from a different angle.
Okay, we're going to have to confess that there's a titter going around.
There is. We're going to come to the tweets.
I dare look behind me.
I'm not going to look.
But can I also just say, am I the only person to make a connection between Max Planck and Delia Smith here? Because
the ovens,
if Max Planck hadn't switched those ovens on, Delia Smith wouldn't have had anything to put in them.
You're right. Now, we're going to go to some tweets now. I've not been reading these, but producer Andy, let's read out some of the more interesting tweets. I don't know. They're all going to be wonderful and incisive, I'm assuming.
It's a Twitter titter in the room, I think, at the minute.
A what?
A Twitter titter. Just a few. There's loads come in so far. SpacePup84 says Tori Amos is a musical genius. Darwin as well, I suppose.
what kind of audience is this?
AEMJ. Alok, you're my favourite genius.
Oh.
Yeah. I Say Woohoo says we have disgustingly ugly walls.
I agree. What's that got to do with genius, though?
Kat DL wanted to know what software it was. It's visibletweets.com, wherever you are. And his Dyson Hoover broke last week. He's not very happy. Ian Samples called this event Glee. I don't understand that particularly.
No, I was saying that sitting in this room beforehand, I just had the feeling when Ben was playing some music, it felt like it was going to turn into an episode from Glee. Especially when I was pacing
Glee?
Around reading his lines. It's just.
Do you watch Glee?
I've noticed it on in the house when I've been in the house.
I can't believe for a second.
I don't know when it's on, I don't know what channel it's on, and I don't know any of the characters' names or any of the storylines.
I just
know they
it.
Sing a lot and they spend a lot of time in basements.
Unbelievable.
Just a couple more. Flushed Fish has travelled from outside London to be here.
Oh, well
done. Is that
done.
True?
Oh, there you are, Flushed Fish. Hello. Well done.
Anyone from further afield? Australia.
You're from Australia.
That's not bad.
Unbelievable. Someone's come from Australia all the way here.
And finally, Stephen Curry has named his geniuses, genii, as Crick, Galileo, and Newton, although he was a bastard.
Newton was a bastard, as we said last week.
Oh, not.
Anyway, for anyone listening outside this room, you can leave your thoughts on our blog, of course, at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And we're going to try out something new. You can check out pictures from tonight at flickr.com/scienceweeklypodcast. If anyone here in the audience wants to upload these mug shots to the same Flickr stream, that'd be very useful.
This is the Guardian Science Weekly podcast.
Now, before being locked into our basement dungeon, we were free to roam around the museum with our microphones. And the first person we're going to come to is Nell. What did you get up to?
I roamed around and ended up talking to Phil Loring about his amazing collection of IQ tests.
The Wechsler is considered still today, in its most recent incarnation, the gold standard. It was a test that was invented by David Wechsler, who was a psychiatrist at Bellevue Hospital in New York. He was working specifically with dementia patients, and he wanted to assess how they were functioning and how their functioning was beginning to decline. He basically assembled a lot of tests that had been developed in other areas before. The first famous intelligence test was called the Stanford-Binet, and that's the one that actually coined the idea of IQ. Wechsler wanted to improve upon that, and so he used pieces from that and pieces from other tests that he had found, and he created something which has become the most influential IQ test around.
So can you give us an example? Give us an example of one of the questions on it.
Sure. It's a range of, and a mix, as all intelligence tests are, of verbal questions that oftentimes ask knowledge that everybody is supposed to know or everybody at a certain level should know. A lot of these come from tests that were done with very small children and also with non-native speakers of English, particularly immigrants coming into America usually. And the idea was that these tests should not test your language skills, but they should test your ability to figure out patterns in blocks or to
reason in some way that's kind not of culturally good. Relative.
Yeah. What I've got in my hand is the British version of the Wechsler. Again, it was invented in America, and they tried to adjust the questions in very ultimately superficial ways that didn't make too much of a difference, but they were designed to be appropriate to British people in the time that this particular test was published. And this test is from 1979. So the very first question, the one that you should be able to answer, is what is 4 pounds and 5 pounds?
How do you mean? Oh, what, plus 9 pounds, I see. Okay.
So.
It was kind of more of a basic concept of pound.
Exactly, and it's also a math question, although framed as a straightforward right. question like that. Another one is, for example, can you tell me what the Quran is?
It's the holy book of Islam. Is that?
Yes.
Brilliant. So, I don't get multiple choice.
And the interesting thing is this is designed to be an individual test. So originally the equivalent of this, it was kind of thought of as a stethoscope, that you would use it in a one-on-one situation to basically feel around somebody's brain and get a sense of what parts of it might be problematic and what parts of it might be functioning perfectly well.
Tester who's getting a sort of general feel for how someone's operating rather than a comparative test of your better than this person, worse than that person.
It's both.
So now, Phil, go on. Give me the hardest question in the book. Andy, you have to promise to edit this out if it all goes horribly wrong.
Okay, the most complicated vocabulary question is, what is a tirade?
It's a stream of abuse or, you know, invective. Is that allowed?
That's allowed.
Cool. Hey, so based on that, how bright am I?
You're off the scale.
Oh, brilliant.
Join our Facebook group. We've handily called ourselves the Guardian Science Weekly podcast, where you can chat with other listeners and post comments on the wall.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Now on to our special guest, Kevin Dutton. Now, Kevin's book, Flipnosis, is about the art of split-second persuasion. This is quite dangerous because I'm worried that all sorts of split-second persuasion is going to be going on during this. And you always worry speaking to someone who knows about psychology that they're psychoanalyzing you in some way. But Kevin, what is flipnosis?
I'll give you a very simple example to explain what it is. Winston Churchill in the 1950s is at a party, a lavish party for Commonwealth dignitaries. It's a white tie and tuxedo affair. And at the end of the evening, Churchill spots a fellow guest about to steal a solid silver salt cellar from the table.
That was a bit of a tongue twister, solid silver salt cellar.
I'm glad I got that out after a couple of bottles of San Miguel. It's not easy, I can tell you. So imagine that was you. Put yourself in that position. What would you do? Well, probably what most of us would do would be to go over to the guy and say, I saw you, whatever, whatever. And you've got a bit of a melee on your hands. On the other hand, you wouldn't want to say nothing. You wouldn't want to let him get away with it. So you've got a real dilemma. So what did Churchill do in this situation? Well, thinking very quickly, he picked up the matching silver pepper pot, put it inside his own coat pocket, walked up to the guy, took it out, put it down quietly in front of them on the table and whispered to him, I think they've seen us. We'd better put them back. Problem resolved simply and elegantly.
Winston Churchill's the example for any sort of stylish conversation point, isn't it?
Or the answer to any pub quiz
satirical question.
You can't argue with Winston Churchill.
Are you sure this is... Anyway, your book's kind of full of these sorts of anecdotes, essentially. It's about different people talking and diffusing situations very, very quickly. I mean, what's so special about... with the one-liner that will sort of diffuse something rather than, you know, people just being generally nice and kind? And what's the difference?
Well, being nice and kind is actually one component. What I did was, I mean, as most academic researchers into social influence, what I thought was that up until about 5 years ago, persuasion was something which was long and drawn out. It was something that worked through trial and error and using due process and negotiation. And Churchill was one of those stories which I came across which made me think of it in a different way. And another situation which made me think of it in a different way was I was walking down the street in New York, and I saw a hungry and homeless guy out on the street, and he had a cardboard placard in front of him. Usually it's pretty hit and miss whether you give money to these guys. But this guy, he couldn't have got the money out of me any quicker if he'd have pulled a gun from his pocket, because I looked at what he had written on the cardboard placard, and it said, been on the street 6 months, schizophrenic, both of us. And I thought, that's absolutely brilliant. And it was almost without thinking that I gave him a couple of dollars, and, you know, we had a bit of a chat. And what I did was I found a load of these kinds of examples of what I call flipnosis, split-second influence, and I put them all together, and I conducted a factor analysis on it with it's a statistical technique to find out what the active ingredients of these kinds of things are. And five components came out, which are called the SPICE model. And the SPICE model stands for simplicity, perceived self-interest, incongruity, confidence, and empathy, which is that touchy-feely thing you were talking about earlier, Alec. And if your message can combine all of those five factors, then you really are going to have a kind of persuasion which is very powerful indeed.
So the other thing that you go into in this book, in case people are wondering that this is just examples of you giving money to people and quoting Winston Churchill, is that this is actually, you've advanced a theory that this is actually quite deep-seated in our evolutionary psychology.
That's right. I mean, it's only, if you think about it, it's only in recent years, and it's only in the human species that persuasion is linguistic. In all the other animal, all the other species in the animal kingdom, persuasion doesn't involve language, and it's only involved language amongst humans in a very recent space of time. And if you look at the way persuasion is done in the animal kingdoms, using sign stimuli, in terms of courtship rituals, etc., these five spice factors are all recapitulated linguistically from really what the way animals communicate.
Now, you're the most persuasive person I know. Well, have you read this book already?
Not yet. I'm definitely about to.
Okay, whatever you say.
But I wondered if you could tell us, how is it possible to kind of train yourself to get better at these things once you've identified them, or to see them, other people using them?
That's a really good question, Ellen. And one of the questions which I'm often asked about this is, can we all be genius persuaders? One of the things which I did was, as an academic, was having known all the theory about persuasion, I also spent some time with some of the world's best con artists and looked at how they did their business and how they persuaded people, and whether their street wisdom, these guys hadn't gone to university or school, whether it tied in with what I knew as an academic. And I found that it did. And one of the main factors about the world's top con men is the fact that persuasion for them is an absolute lifestyle. It's not something that they turn on or off. So my primary answer to anyone that says, how can I be a better persuader, apart from buy the book, which is on sale $9.99 out there, I'm signing for one night only, apart from that, is to actually work at it. You've got to practice it. You've got to go out and persuade people on a daily basis, and it's a skill. It's partly skill and it's partly attitude. So there are partly it's partly to do with factors in your personality, which you can work on, but also a lot of the time we just don't try and persuade people enough, and it's a skill that you can hone.
Now, Ian, you're a master con artist, having to deal with Guardian news desks all the time and explaining science stories to them. Somehow you managed to get a story about dark matter into the paper once. I don't know how. So what's your skill in this area particularly?
The news desk has a whole different psychology, but I guess this does lead on, is that later in your book, Kevin, you talk about how psychopaths are incredibly good persuaders, and you know, even these split-second persuaders. But what I didn't understand about that was that surely these guys surely score low on empathy. And so how can you be a very good persuader if you do not empathize with where the other person is coming from?
That's a really good question, Ian, as well. And in fact, I'm now writing a second book, which is called The Wisdom of Psychopaths. So thanks for the plug there. I can't pretend that I wasn't really thankful to be asked that question. But one of the things which is a common misnomer about psychopaths is that
they don't
feel empathy. They can't emote, or they can't empathise and sympathise with other people's positions. In fact, there's evidence to suggest that psychopaths are better at doing that than the rest of us. They don't do it through using the emotional part of their brain, the amygdala and the emotional circuits of the brain. They co-opt the cold circuits of the brain, the cognitive discernment, the cold reading ability, to perform that task for them. And there was a fantastic study which was conducted not long ago by a psychologist. I'm not sure where she was or where she is, but she found it very interesting that the American serial killer Ted Bundy said in an interview that he was able to pick up people who were emotionally vulnerable, who were weak, just from the way that they walked and carried themselves. And so this psychologist, whose name escapes me, took a bunch of psychopaths and compared their performance with normal people, and had a load of people walking down a corridor in a university building. And one of these people who was walking down the corridor had suffered a traumatic attack. But of course, nobody knew, apart from the experimenters, which one that was. And it turned out that Bundy's insight was correct. He was telling the truth. The psychopaths were far better at picking up on the person who had been previously attacked, just from the way that they were walking.
Is this the basis of Silence of the Lambs or something? This is the storyline of Silence of the Lambs.
It could well be, yeah.
Okay. Well, look, before we wind up this section, Kevin, can you explain to the audience there a bit about your trick from before? So just quickly go through again. You were showing them all numbers. They had to read them out and add them up in their heads as they went along. What was the right answer?
The right answer. Does anybody remember it? We got to 4,090 plus 10. What was the right answer?
10. Hang on. 4,090
plus 10 is? 4,090 plus 10. Yeah, the right answer was 4,000. Well, it was better off without the numbers here, weren't we? The right answer was 4,100. And, of course, what happened when we got to 4,090 plus 10, the brain rounded it up to the nicest, nearest whole number that was at hand, and that was 5,000. And the brain does that all the time. We don't have the time in our lives to work everything out from scratch, to decide on a course of action from scratch. So we use what's called cognitive heuristics, or shortcuts. And that explains the very first component of the SPICE model, simplicity. The brain has a real penchant for simplicity and confuses the ease with which it takes in information with the value of the information itself. So that's just a little taster of the first component.
Kevin, thank you. That was slightly terrifying. Now, Ian, you were also allowed to run loose in the Spectacular Museum today. What did you choose to see?
I went off and found a woman called Tilly, who talked me through this staggering and enormous reconstruction of the Charles Babbage difference engine. And she also showed me his brain, which they've got here as well.
Well, we're standing in front of Babbage's difference engine number 2, which was a machine that he designed in 1840s, but wasn't actually built during his lifetime. It's effectively a great big calculator, but it's really one of the icons of the early, pre-computing age. It's a machine that works out polynomial equations, so it uses something called the method of finite differences to work out polynomial equations using only addition. So it's a very clever machine in that it can use just addition to work that out to seventh order differential equations.
That sounds like a very specific type of mathematical equation, but were there practical uses for these things at the time that were being done sort of manually?
Absolutely. I mean, mathematical tables were used by a whole range of different professions. They were used in banking, they were used by engineers, by scientists, they were used for navigation. And these tables were absolutely riddled with errors. They were calculated by humans, who were then known as calculators, so literally people sitting down calculating the machines. And they were written down again and again, which meant that again they introduced lots and lots of errors as those books of tables were written down. So Babbage's big idea was, how do you create a machine that will do this automatically and will stop any errors coming in and will stop errors being repeated as it's printed? And so what he did was, he sat down and tried to work out how he would create such a machine. He designed a series of difference engines, but he never actually completed a whole machine. So he created the first machine, the difference engine number 1, which is actually only 1/7 of the ultimate machine. And he used that to entice people into developing funding for his project. So he would invite people around to his house in Manchester Square in London on a Saturday night. He'd give them dinner and they'd have a bit of a party, and he would show off his various ideas.
Why did he never actually complete it like your engineers have?
It was a very, very complex machine, but also he was a difficult character. So he fell out with his engineer. He worked with the best engineer at the time, Joseph Clement. But they had a series of arguments over, the movement of the workshop nearer to Babbage's house. And he was a difficult man to work for, so they never actually completed the machine.
Tilly, before I let you go, I want you to talk to me about this thing over here, which I can't quite believe, but what is in that jar?
That's 1/2 of Babbage's brain.
And what are you doing with it?
It's actually on loan to us from the Royal College of Surgeons, but it represents a time when great thinkers' brains were preserved. There was an understanding that if you were believed to have made some great intellectual leaps, then that, you know, the brains of great men were preserved for future prosperity. So to have your brain preserved in this way, or one half of it as we have here, was really a kind of symbol of what you represented in society and how successful you had been.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
And finally, let's hear from our eager audience. Now, it's late at night now. They're fueled on alcohol, I hope. And who knows what might happen. We've talked about geniuses, split-second decisions, ancient computers, and IQ tests. We're going to pass around a microphone. So if you want to put your hands up, let's see who wants to ask a question. Ah, there at the back. Now, when we get you the microphone, remember to tell us who you are, where you're from, who your favourite genius is, then ask a question. Off you go.
Hi, I'm Tom from Balham. My favourite genius is... This is actually my question as well. Roger Federer. You think scientists can be geniuses? Like, oh, I just thought how far you think it could stretch. Do you think someone like Roger Federer could be a genius?
Okay, could Richard Federer be a genius?
Roger.
I'm clearly not a genius. Could Roger
Alex
Federer...
Alex, good tennis knowledge there.
Roger Federer, I know nothing about sports, honestly. Roger Federer, could he be a genius? Kevin?
Absolutely. I'm a huge Roger Federer fan myself.
And Richard Federer, no?
Not Richard Federer. No, I don't know who Richard Federer is, Alec. Roger Federer, I would say he's... I don't think that genius should necessarily be compartmentalised just into academic or creative fields. I mean, you can, in fact, boil sporting ability down to split-second decisions in the brain. We know, for instance, that the top tennis players can basically predict where their opponent is going to hit a ball even before the ball has been hit, which separates them out from novice performers. So in a sense, I suppose you could say that is a cognitive ability which underpins his sporting prowess and the sporting prowess of a lot of top tennis players. Absolutely, I would say Roger Federer is a bona fide genius, Tom.
Okay, next question, anyone?
Hi there, my name's Sam, I'm from Southwest London. I was just interested in whether or not the panel thought that people like Kim Peek, people who are savants or somewhere on the autistic spectrum, who are very, very capable at one particular thing, but perhaps completely inept in many others, are they geniuses?
Okay, so are savants geniuses? That's interesting.
Did you mention Tim Peake? Okay, so that's a separate issue from the savant issue, I'm presuming.
Not the Tim Peake, the astronaut.
Oh.
Kim Peake.
We have name problems. I've no idea who Kim Peake is.
All right. Kevin, what about savants? What do you think?
I don't know who Kim Peake is either, but it's a tricky one. Rather than calling them geniuses, I would probably cop out slightly and say that they have... islets of genius about them, but whether that even means the same thing or not, I'm not sure. I think a lot of savants, their genius is particularly ploughs a narrow furrow. But I suppose you could also say that about Roger Federer. I mean, Roger Federer is a brilliant tennis player, but I don't know how good he is at, you know, IQ tests.
Or quantum physics, for example.
Or quantum physics.
There's a sort of overlap there, isn't there, between the kind of concept of a polymath and a concept of a genius, and there's a sort of temptation to conflate the two,
sure.
Which certainly I've fallen into earlier this evening. So you could possibly apply genius to Kim Peake, but obviously not polymath.
There's a gentleman here at the front, then a lady there.
Stephen Curry. I'm from Ballymena. My genius was Max Perutz, crystallographer. My question's for Ian, really, which is about the Babbage difference engine. If that had been built in his lifetime, do you think it would have accelerated the development of the computer?
It was a question that came up when Tilly was talking, and she said that... I'm not going to pretend to know the answer. She said that there are a lot of people who think that if that had been built at the time... It may not have been groundbreaking, actually. It may not have been like direction-changing in terms of the actual progression of computing as it happened. She said that instead of thinking of him as like the grandfather of computing, a lot of people felt of him as like the granduncle of computing. So he was doing an excellent thing, and he was trying to model how thinking might be done, you know, by humans in some kind of abstract way. But maybe wasn't quite at the, you know, the starting point that a lot of people think of him as. I bow to her greater knowledge on that. I don't know. What do you think?
I think there's nothing like a live demonstration to inspire people, so I do wonder if it might have stimulated some people to think who otherwise were left fallow.
I think that's a really good point. And there was also, I didn't realise, but the analytical engine was something that he was doing around the same time. I thought there was something he did much later. And this was a steam-driven device that was far more complex. And he was doing extraordinary things. And I totally take your point. And when you see that machine at work, it's completely inspiring. And you would hope that it would trigger something. I'm sure we'd be in a different place. But whether, you know, I suppose this is down to historians. What do you think of... I don't know where that would go.
Well, one more question from Lady at the back. Tell us who you are, where you're from, and your favourite genius.
I'm Louise. I'm Lulu Crumble on Twitter, just up there right now. My favourite genius is the composer Max Richter. I want to ask the panel if they think that genius is innate or it's something that can be acquired.
Good question. Ian Sample, is genius innate or did you acquire it?
By the way, Ian, I loved your work in Quantum of Solace.
I did too. I want to know when the next Bond film is going to be
any good.
How many
buses did you jump on that motorbike? Sorry, I have a stupid joke that Alok looks like Evel Knievel, even though he doesn't.
Mine's not a joke. You do look like...
No, really, that's the irony of it.
Is it innate?
The question...
I mean, this sounds really Gladwellian. I mean... It's got to matter if you have the right opportunities in life, and I think those are probably chance events. I'm sure there are an awful lot of geniuses that we never get to hear about because the cards just don't fall right for them, and that kind of matters to me. Innate, I'm sure the ability to be a genius is innate. I think it has to be. But when it comes to fruition, no.
Kevin, very quick line from you on that.
Yeah, I concur with Ian on that. I also just like to add, I think it's quite interesting that when we use the label genius, there is sometimes a touch of social construction about it. If you take, for instance, like snooker, geniuses are usually used as a moniker, say, for people like Ronnie O'Sullivan or Alex Higgins, people who are slightly wayward, bohemian and crazy, whereas people like, say, Steve Davis or Stephen Hendry are more seen as ambassadors for the sport, and yet they're arguably just as talented. So I think there's an element of personality as a cult of genius as well.
Okay, Kevin, thank you very much. Well, that's all we have time for today, in question-wise. Well, that's it for our very first ever live recording. If it sounds any good, we may well do it again, perhaps even a world tour. My thanks to our very own genii, Nell Bowes and Daniel Craig. Sorry, Ian Sample. Dr. Kevin Dutton, too, whose book Flipgnosis is out now. Thanks also to all the brilliant staff here at the Science Museum and, of course, to you, our live studio audience. You can upload your pictures of tonight to flickr.com/scienceweeklypodcast. And if you want to see some comments, look back through the SW Live hashtag on Twitter. Now, using some of the persuasion techniques that we've just learned, I'm going to try and make you listen to next week's podcast. Ahead of the World Cup, we're going to be looking at some of the physics and stats behind football. Plus, we'll have the highlights of a debate at the Guardian Hay Festival. It's all about the 10th anniversary of the Human Genome Project and will be chaired by our very own Observer Science editor, Robin McKee. Don't forget, you can add your voice and comments to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. All the links to everything we've talked about are there tonight. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth and Ben Cape, with not a little help from James Kingsland and our glamorous assistant, Celia Cole. I'm Alok Jha. Thank you very much for listening.
It was really good. It was kind of like sort of being down the pub with a bunch of guys that had some interesting things to say, really, and just listening in on that conversation.
Well, it was fun to see it live. I listen fairly regularly, usually when I'm running.
I particularly like the fact that it was actually recorded in front of a live audience, so it just made it really, really dynamic, and it got everybody involved.
It was also nice to hear that genius isn't necessarily just academic, that Roger Federer might be a genius. Actors like Johnny Depp may well be a genius.
Well, it was nice to meet Ian Sample there and to put a face to Nell Bowes, whose voice I'm quite fond of. I thought it worked well. I hope you'll do it again. I mean, it was lively, friendly, very accessible. so it was a good night.
Yeah, it just went a lot more smoothly than I expected.
You're now locked in the museum. We closed the door, so we can't get all that. Very thin. So you can just hang on.
So you're locked in the museum. Oh no.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.